Our knowledge of SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19 is evolving rapidly. We now know that many patients have symptoms and injuries related to damaged blood vessels and blood clots throughout the body. There are still many unanswered questions, but endothelial injury and hypercoagulability must be anticipated when COVID-19 is suspected in a patient. I'm Dr. Kirsten Patrick, Executive Editor for CMAJ. Today I'm talking to Dr. Patrick Lawler and Dr. Lucas Godoy, who have co-authored an article on coagulopathy and thrombotic manifestations of severe COVID-19. The article is published in CMAJ. Dr. Lawler is a cardiologist at the Peter Munk Cardiac Center in Toronto and a clinician scientist at the Toronto General Hospital Research Institute. Dr. Lucas Godoy is a cardiologist and research fellow at the Peter Munk Cardiac Center in Toronto. I've reached them today in Toronto. Welcome.
Hi, Kristen. Thanks for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
Lucas, let's begin with you. Can you tell us how common are thrombotic manifestations or endothelial injury in patients with COVID-19?
Yeah, sure. That's an important question. So the rate actually varies according to the different reports in the literature. So we can say that it's somewhere between 5 to 30% of the patients with COVID that are hospitalized end up developing a thrombotic event. And the reason for this variation might be the severity of the patients that are included in each one of these reports. So the first reports we have from China and then from Europe, they tend to include more patients in the critical care unit. They were more severe patients, and those patients that are at a higher risk of developing a thrombotic event. Now, the most recent reports, they also included patients from the wards with not so severe COVID disease. And, you know, the rates then are a bit lower. So that's the reason for this variation. But it's important to realize that COVID seems to be related to thrombotic events in a more important way than other similar conditions like influenza. Even, you know, when you are dealing with less severe patients. So that's the importance of this topic.
Can I clarify with you, you're not able to say from the evidence that we have what my likelihood of having a thrombotic event would be if I were to get COVID. You can only say within hospitalized patients, it's this common.
Yes, that's correct. COVID, only around 10% max of the patients end up going to the hospital. And the evidence that we have for the thrombotic rates are really for these patients. We don't have right now a lot of data for outpatients with COVID. Most of the evidence that we have are for patients that at least needed to be hospitalized. So as I said in the beginning, it was only for ICU patients. Now we also know a bit about patients that are not that critical, not that sick. But for outpatients, it's a bit more difficult to know exactly what would be that rate. Probably lower than hospitalized patients, but it's really hard to say.
Patrick, can we anticipate or predict which patients are more likely to be susceptible to coagulopathies?
It's a quickly moving, rapidly moving target, and I think the evidence is accumulating, very quickly. You know, some of the biomarkers that people have looked at to try to ascertain risk are things like D-dimer. D-dimer obviously is a marker in general of intravascular coagulation, but there may be imprecision to using it as such in patients with COVID. For example, there's a sense that augmented bradykinin activity leads to extravascular tissue factor binding, which then causes extravascular clotting pathways to be activated. D-dimer seeps back into the bloodstream, but isn't actually associated with intravascular clot in that setting. And something similar to that is seen in hereditary angioedema attacks, where bradykinin is particularly active. So there's a sense that that's a marker of interest, and many have indeed shown that that does certainly is associated with outcomes. But the exact way by which we should ascertain that risk is definitely a moving target, and I think it's a great question. As Lucas says, we increasingly appreciate, I think, that, you know, across the spectrum of illness severity, those that have really quite a high burden of disease are much more likely to have one of these thrombotic events. And it's important to mention and conceptualize that these events likely do cluster together. As you started out by saying, the endothelial injury, of course, is a systemic injury, And the manifestations of such could be a macrovascular event, such as myocardial infarction or stroke on the arterial side, or a thromboembolic event, such as a TVT or pulmonary embolism on the venous side. But that may also track with other microvascular thrombotic processes causing things like renal failure or secondary demand type MI, myocardial infarction, and respiratory failure, of course. So, all that to say, I think certainly the sick patients are those in whom to think about it more, although it certainly is, Lucas says, is a problem across the illness severity spectrum. And I do think, at least at the moment, D-dimer is a reasonable place to start, accepting that there is imprecision, and the quest to find more accurate markers is certainly underway.
And how exactly does SARS-CoV lead to disordered coagulation? I mean, what do we know about the cellular mechanism?
Increasingly, I think it's clear that the virus uses the ACE2 receptor as its host receptor, which allows it to be uptaken into the vascular endothelium. That causes a diffuse endotheliitis, causes direct endothelial damage, both from the viral infection and then also from the secondary host response that is triggered in response to that endothelial injury. So the body's own system then proceeds to attack the endothelium. All that endothelial damage, as it always does in other settings, leads to upregulation of coagulation pathways, and those in turn cause in situ thrombosis. That seems to be particularly a problem with SARS-CoV-2. In general, in things like influenza, there is a sense that heightened inflammation does cause direct activation of thrombotic pathways, and there certainly is an immunothrombotic kind of activation pathway that is present really in all infections, but it's particularly a problem in COVID because of this diffuse endotheliopathy that develops as a result of the infection.
So expanding on that thought of diffuse endotheliopathy, and that tissues all over the body are, supplied by arteries and veins, what are some of the thrombotic events that patients with COVID-19 might have? Give us an idea.
Well, so Patrick touched a bit on that. And if you get the whole spectrum of coagulopathy, you can have thrombotic or bleeding events. And from what you know right now, COVID is more related to thrombotic events rather than bleeding. Bleeding might happen as well, but it doesn't seem to be that common. And when it happens, it may be more related to consumptive coagulopathy rather than a primary bleeding disorder caused by COVID. So it's more thrombotic. And amongst thrombotic events, we can have venous or arterial thrombotic events. And COVID may cause both. We have more reports in the literature of the venous thrombotic events, so they seem to be more important right now. From venous thrombotic events, we're talking basically about pulmonary embolism and deep venous thrombosis and pulmonary embolism. It's important to highlight there is a big discussion right now in the literature if what we see in the lungs in patients with COVID is really the thrombi that we see there. It's really the origin of that is from the venous thrombosis, or rather a primary thrombotic primary formation of thrombus in the lungs. So it's not clear yet. It might be the case that since the virus is causes so much inflammation in the lungs, it might be triggering thrombosis to happen directly and primarily in the lungs rather than embolus from the lower limbs. Regarding arterial events, there have been lots of them reported. So cardiac injury seems to be common in patients with COVID. Up to 20% of hospitalized patients with COVID develop cardiac injury. That could be only a troponin leak, but can also be myocardial infarction, so caused by a thrombotic event in the coronary arteries. So that seems to be the most important of the arterial thrombosis events. We can also have stroke, and others such as acute limb ischemia and even mesenteric ischemia have been reported in patients with COVID.
So we can get some indication of coagulopathy and what's happening in that regard through biomarkers. What are some of the abnormalities that we may identify in patients with COVID who are at risk of coagulopathy?
So we touched on D-dimer earlier, and I think that's probably where most of the spotlight has focused. It probably, my opinion is probably the marker which has the most validated kind of evidence base behind it. Again, with all the caveats mentioned, all the imprecision, it does seem to probably be the best one that we've got. There certainly are other markers of coagulopathy. As Lucas says, with the coagulopathy in COVID, as well as with DIC in general, of course, there's an intravascular coagulation pathways which are upregulated, but then that can progress to a consumptive picture that then kind of turns the tables and increases the risk of bleeding as clotting factors are degraded. So certainly monitoring the clotting factors in concert throughout the process is really, really important, I think. It does seem that the DIC in COVID is different than the DIC conventionally, so we're still getting a sense of what the targets and the goals should be, but certainly watching the whole spectrum of biomarkers, I think could have coagulation biomarkers that is, of course, could improve an understanding of an individual patient's, trajectory on that coagulopathy pathway. As Lucas says, we certainly do think that a lot of the end organ injury is because of likely small in situ thrombosis. And so markers of organ injury in general are likely to be correlated with the risk of developing a macroscopic thrombotic event that would require treatment. So there are some institutions, for example, that have protocolized following things like troponin, other markers of organ injury that could, in theory, herald that this process is going on. And there are even some institutions that have advocated for empirically fully anticoagulating patients if their D-dimers above a certain cutoff. It's certainly not standard of care, but it is a practice that many institutions have started to think about and some have started to do. So great question. In summary, we don't have great markers. I think D-dimer is probably the best we have. Important to track all of them in concert, and other markers of organ injury would probably be helpful to follow in those patients at risk.
So you spoke about institutions protocolizing certain investigations, and I wondered what your institution has done in that regard.
So it's a good question. I'm in University Health Network in Toronto. We've certainly had a lot of discussions, and it's been a little bit of a moving target. We have a number of diverse practice settings, have taken care of these patients. Of course, we're fortunate that our caseload is very low at this particular day in which we're talking. But there has been a sense, at least the cardiology community has, for example, recommended sort of an active cardiac surveillance program. The checking of D-dimers has certainly at some points been part of the baseline admission order set type thing. But again, it sort of has varied as the process has gone on. So I think it may be better for me to speak to my own thoughts. I think my own thoughts would be that D-dimer probably does have prognostic significance in somebody that has an equivocal or uncertain prognosis, such as someone coming into the hospital and whom you're not sure if they're going to be, what direction they're going to go in. And I think those kinds of prognostic biomarkers can certainly be helpful. In someone who's already in the ICU and receiving organ failure support, perhaps those markers are less useful. They already know that something bad is happening clinically. So, my thought would probably be that I would check those markers at baseline. I do think that surveying some things like troponin, things can herald a potential clinical deterioration, which can occur abruptly, unfortunately, in these patients. So I think those types of surveillance approaches, I tend to think are probably worthwhile. I tend to be someone in general in my practice who likes a lot of objective data, but I think in the absence of really understanding the problem, questions about what clinical trajectories may unfold for a given patient, I think gathering as much evidence as possible would make sense. And I think those markers can be useful.
Yeah, even the clinical society guidelines, they are not uniform, their recommendations regarding the best approach, if you should order or not the dimer. I think most would say yes, it's important to order the dimer because of those things Patrick just mentioned, but you can find in the literature different opinions as well. So it's really hard to come up with a very standardized protocol or recommendation that would fit every scenario in every set of practice.
That makes sense. So moving on from diagnosis and clinical appraisal, once you've realized that there are clinical manifestations of coagulopathy, how are these best managed?
So we generally, I think many are taking the approach that they should be managed as they conventionally are. So, a DVT should prompt full dose anticoagulation, pulmonary embolism as such, and the duration of that, it's really not known in COVID, but there's a sense that we would just follow the usual clinical practice guidelines for those types of events. The management of myocardial infarction and the provision of catheter-based approaches is something that varies from institution to institution, but I would say broadly the sense is that we've managed these conditions and complications as we would have managed them outside of COVID.
So nothing special for COVID patients, not earlier intervention?
Well, it's a good question about whether preemptive strategies are worth considering. There are a number of planned and actually a number of ongoing clinical trials looking at whether a strategy of initial empiric full-dose anticoagulation is superior to a strategy of more reactive usual thromboprophylactic low doses that then get escalated in the presence of a DVT or PE or other clinical indication. A couple of those trials are being led in Canada. One of them, Lucas and I are part of, called the ATTACK trial. It's an adaptive Bayesian trial that is looking at the concept of doing full-dose heparin right out of the gates when a patient is admitted to the hospital versus, as I say, kind of more of a watchful waiting with thromboprophylaxis and then an escalation to one of these higher intensity strategies in the event that the patient develops a clinical, conventional clinical indication. The thought is that the clinical manifestations of thrombosis that we have mentioned, such as DVT and PE, MI, and stroke, and systemic arterial embolization, are the kind of clinically detectable and conventional consequences of that. As Lucas says, we do think that other mechanisms of organ failure are likely to be underlined by this thrombotic cascade as well. And so the thought in this case is that some of those antithrombotics could have an effect to actually prevent organ failure and prevent patients from needing ICU level therapies and possibly dying. So a lot of this, it's a very, very exciting sort of landscape. I think a lot of those trials are actively enrolling, as I say, some of them led out of Canada. It's really very exciting. I think we, you know, hope to have answers in the next 6 months or so from these. There's been an emerging partnerships to try to get answers as quickly as possible through collaboration, which I think are unprecedented and really exciting. But it's still very much an open question. And I think at this stage, as Lucas has highlighted, the guidelines are very much, you know, conventional low-dose thromboprophylaxis and, you know, see how patients do. And I think these are opportunities for us to test whether something more proactive might be the right approach. I would say the trial is active in a number of centers throughout Canada. And if there is interest, of course, I don't mean to promote it, but I'm sure that there would be an opportunity to collaborate if any listeners would like to learn more.
We've talked about that this is a rapidly evolving area, moving target in terms of evidence. And you've, in your article, highlighted a number of resources that clinicians can look to. What are some of these main resources that they might want to use?
We have combined some of these resources in the article. It's in the box two, as we put it there. So there are some society guidelines, as the European Society of Cardiology, they put together a document with guidance for the diagnosis and management of cardiovascular disease during COVID. And they also talk a lot about thrombotic events in that document. The International Society for Thrombosis and Hemostasis also have a guidance document on how to diagnose it, to do the diagnosis and the management of coagulopathy in patients with COVID. I think those would be for clinicians the some of the most important guidelines that you have available right now. There are other recommendations from other entities, such as the National Institutes of Health in the US. Thrombosis Canada also has their recommendation. We also put together a list of places to find ongoing clinical trials in patients with COVID. So, you know, people might be interested to know what trials are going on, where they live, or where they can reference patients to. So you have some references there where people can search for current clinical trials in patients with COVID and coagulopathy, or testing anticoagulant interventions in general in patients with COVID.
Thanks for writing this brilliant comprehensive article for CMAJ. I guess the take-home message is for clinicians to be aware that patients with COVID-19 may well develop coagulopathy and be prepared to manage it if necessary.
That's very well summarized. And thanks for the privilege to contribute. It's really been a great opportunity for us too.
Thank you for the invitation.
I've been speaking with Drs. Patrick Lawler and Lucas Godoy, cardiologists at the Peter Munk Cardiac Center in Toronto. To read the article they co-authored, visit cmaj.ca. Also, don't forget to subscribe to CMAJ podcasts on SoundCloud or a podcast app, and let us know how we're doing by leaving a rating. I'm Dr. Kirsten Patrick, executive editor for CMAJ. Thanks for listening.